You are listening to Aloud, a program of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit us at lfla.org.
Good evening and welcome. I'm Stacey Lieberman. I'm the president and CEO of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. And before we begin the program, in the spirit of reconciliation, the Los Angeles Public Library recognizes and acknowledges the First Peoples of this land. We pay our respect to their elders, past and present, and extend that respect to all Indigenous peoples today. For those not familiar with the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, we're a private nonprofit organization devoted to fundraising, advocacy, and public programming in support of the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you to the many Library Foundation members who are here with us this evening. And if you are not yet a member, I hope you'll consider joining the LFLA to continue to see and experience more programs like this one, and to support critical library services and initiatives for children, teens, and adults all over Los Angeles, helping them to improve their lives and achieve their dreams. Our winter-spring season of Library Foundation's Aloud public programming is well underway, and please visit lfla.org/aloud to see our varied and dynamic season. And thank you for joining us this evening to hear Colin Campbell upon the publication of his book, Finding the Words, Working Through Profound Loss with Hope and Purpose, in conversation with Sharon Brous. Colin is a writer and director of film and television who teaches screenwriting at Chapman University and theater at Cal Poly Pomona. His one-person show titled Grief, a One-Man Shit Show, premiered at the Hollywood Fringe Festival, where it won a Best of Broadwater Award. Rabbi Sharon Brous is a leading voice in reanimating religious life in America, working to develop a spiritual roadmap for a soulful, justice-driven, and multi-faith ethos in Los Angeles and around the country. She is the senior and founding rabbi of ICAR that launched in 2004 and quickly became one of the fastest growing and most influential Jewish congregations in the country. I am a member of ICAR, as are Colin and his wife Gail, and Rabbi Brous is our rabbi. Rather than shying away from difficult conversations, she embraces the opportunity to have them together. I read Colin's book last weekend, and I am still absorbing what a profound, beautiful, sensitive, and heart-stretching guide to life it is. One of the things you will hear about this evening is the importance of community when navigating loss. It feels fitting to bring this conversation to the stage at the Los Angeles Public Library, which has been a beacon in our communities for 150 years. The library is celebrating its 150th anniversary now, and it is a place, one of the few places, where all are welcome and all can find support, inspiration, and hope. Please join me in welcoming Colin Campbell and Rabbi Sharon Brous.
All right. Hi, everyone. Good evening. It's really a pleasure to be with all of you tonight, and a great honor to be seated next to my friend, and in many ways also my teacher, and to engage in this conversation this evening just at the launch of your book. I just want to thank you all for pulling this together so beautifully, and Stacy's been a beloved member of our community, as she said, really for many years, and so it's quite wonderful to be able to share in this in the good work that the library's doing here, so thank you. Thank you both. So Colin, and I believe Gail is here somewhere.
Yes.
Hi, love.
Hello,
hi.
Wife.
This book is an incredible triumph. It is absolutely breathtaking. Congressman Jamie Raskin said it is an astonishing and near miraculous achievement. And he said it feels like a prayer. I read the book before he wrote those words when it was in manuscript form. And then I read it after he wrote those words. I read it again, and it does feel like a prayer, in the way that prayer is meant to be, the most honest, heartfelt calling out of a deep truth, and this feels so beautifully and brilliantly honest, and I'm so grateful for your honesty, because you didn't have to share this with the world, and I know that doing so was an act of love for Ruby and Hart, for Gail, and really an act of love for the world, so that we could learn how to hold our own broken hearts and how to hold each other during this time. So I just want to start, first of all, by thanking you.
Thank you.
Thank you for writing, and thank you for speaking and for teaching us. I love Colin and Gail very much, and I loved Ruby and Hart, who grew up in our community. And so I want to dedicate this evening to them, and I want for all of us to leave knowing a little bit more about Ruby and Hart than we did when we came in the room. So some people here knew them very well, and some people not at all. So in their memory and in the spirit of lifting them up so that their names might be known and reverberate through this world forever, we begin this conversation. So yeah. if we can start by you just telling us, give us the story that led you to the story that appears in this book.
Yes. So those of you who don't know, so my wife Gail and I, we were in Joshua Tree with Ruby and Hart. Joshua Tree is like 2.5 hours east of here. Beautiful little town nestled in the side of a hill with spectacular views and this amazing rocks. And over the years, Gail and I and Ruby and Hart have gone out to Joshua Tree and had amazing times out there. We all loved scrambling up the rocks. That was just our thing as a family. And then in 2019, sort of on a kind of crazy whim, we were like, what if we should just look at some properties? Could we afford like a little house somewhere here instead of just always coming to rent something? And we found a place and we all fell in love with it. And it just was kind of a rundown shack, but it's a beautiful location. So we bought it. And then 3 nights later, I was going to go out there all by myself. This is the more rough part of it all. But I was going to go by myself to talk to a contractor about could we build a pool there and could we build a little outbuilding where Ruby could draw. She's an amazing artist, and where Hart could game with his friends. And then Gail said, oh, let's make it a romantic getaway. And then Ruby found out and said, hey, wait a minute. I want to go too. We're all going to go. So we all went. And then a drunken high driver hit us just as, I don't know if you know Joshua Tree, but you go up this amazing hill up to Morongo Canyon, and just after we crested the hill, we were struck by the drunk driver. And Ruby and Hart were killed in the back seat. And Gail and I were hurt, but not catastrophically so, which also felt very surreal. Later on, we could walk. You know, we literally walked away, essentially. And it was very hard, a lot of dissonance. You know, how did we survive and they didn't? And then we had to cope with, you know, that car ride home from the hospital after kissing Hart goodbye in the ICU, and the PICU, because they took him off life support because they essentially died on impact, but at any rate. and we arrived back home, this empty home, and I had no tools with which to grieve. Culturally, my family just was not a family that grieved. But I had to. There was no escape, right? And Gail's Jewish, and we have a rabbi. So it was very convenient for me that we had the Jewish traditions of grieving. And they were this amazing lifeline to me. And then just a few hours after we got home, suddenly Sharon was there with Melissa Balaban helping us.
Colin, you know, so many people, when they hear this story, whether they knew your kids or not, whether they know you and Gail or not, they say, how does someone even survive that? And I think the book is an answer to that question in many ways. It's this, you know, this beautiful, poetic, honest, sometimes very funny, and very serious answer to that question. And I wonder if you can take us through tonight some of the answer of how you survive it. And I mean, each chapter directs us more and more deeply into, and I think what's interesting about the book is it's really not linear, because the grief is not linear, even though you note that you can see the changes over the course of time. But there are a variety of aspects of kind of lifelines that you discovered through the course of, especially that first year. And I wonder if you can take us through what you see as some of the kind of the foundational elements of survival during that time.
Yeah, yeah. You know, it's interesting. A lot of people say, like, oh, I wouldn't survive it, right? You know, and it's like, well, you would. You don't just die. Yeah, you could kill yourself, but then does that help? Like, you have to really think about this, right? Like, okay. You don't just automatically die. And would I kill myself? Is that a great solution? Is that a great answer to the situation? Ruby, our daughter, struggled with OCD and depression and suicidality, and she fought hard for her life. She fought hard to get her OCD and depression under control, and she did. And she became this rock star. I say in my show, this rock star of empathy and life force and inspiration. And it's like, well, I can't, I would never do that. I would never kill myself, because that would be a betrayal of Ruby, everything she believed in and fought for. I could never do that. So how do I live, right? How do you survive? And there was a moment. It was like 2 days after the crash. We had these big pictures of Ruby and Hart from the funeral, about 3 by 3 foot by 2 foot photos, and I taped them to the walls of our living room. We had four of them, and it was just like to be able to see their faces in our house. And we actually asked our friend Yamar to do four more. So we had eight big photos of their beautiful faces blown up on our living room and wall. And then just one morning early on, I looked up, and then I couldn't look at them. It hurt too much, right? It was so painful. And I looked away, and I was like, oh my God, I'm looking away from my own children because I'm scared of the pain. And I shouted out through tears, I'm not afraid of you. I'm not afraid of you. Because how could I turn away from my own children? And that was an amazing moment for me, because it was like, okay, so then I'm going to lean into the pain. I'm not going to be scared of the pain, because I'm not going to let anything get between me and the love of my children. No. So I'm going to lean into it. But in terms of like lifelines, it was really the Jewish traditions of grieving. It's not just because I have a rabbi here. it really is. Because again, I knew nothing about grieving, nothing. And I learned so many lessons. Even from the funeral, I talk about these in the book, but even the funeral, what happens is you, the closest one, I guess, in this case, the parents, Gail and I, we had to take dirt and throw it on the coffin, or at least the cement covering of the coffin. And so we were literally burying our children. And then we had to sit and watch the entire community continue to bury the children. So everybody in our community that gathered at the cemetery shoveled, well, I guess, three shovels or one, or whatever. They all buried Ruby and Hart right in front of us. And on one level, it's like, oh my God, we have to sit here and watch this? That's insane. It's like punishment. It's cruel. But there's so much denial in profound loss that was helpful. That was like, yes, we can't turn away. We have to enter into this. And then right after that, another beautiful moment of the tradition is that our community lined up in rows on either side, and we walked through them. And it was a powerful moment, because when we were delivering the eulogies, it was just sort of like a crowd of people, and we were just talking to a crowd. Now suddenly we were encountering them one at a time, we looking at their faces and then looking at us, and in a way that's like, we're encountering them now that we've crossed over into a new world. So now we've lost our children, and we have a new relationship to everybody in our community. And here we are looking at them. And it was a beautiful to feel their love. And like you describe them as guardrails, right? The guardrails, so we don't just fall off the cliff. And then there's Shiva. So you, for the first 7 nights after the funeral, but not on Shabbos, the crowd comes to your home and sits with you. And I remember feeling like, no, why is this happening? People are coming into my house and I'm in this state. I don't want to be left alone. I want to just curl up and die in my bed. And then I discovered that actually, oh, this is so helpful. Mm-hmm. It's so extraordinary to be able to talk. You had the wisdom to say, do you want to talk to the crowd of people here, Gail and Colin, who love you? And we did. We really did, and we really needed to. And I discovered suddenly that, I want to talk about Ruby and Hart and about my grief. I've been thinking all day long about this insane thing that I'm experiencing. It's this catastrophic, like, out-of-body experience, bigger than anything I've ever had in my life. I want to talk about it to other people. And it makes sense. We want to talk. If we see a good movie, we want to talk about it to people, right? You see a funny thing happen, you want to share it with people. And this incredible experience of agony, I want to share it. And it helps. It helped me.
This is thus the title of the book, Finding the Words. And you talk about how we have, at some point, we've taken on this kind of cultural norm of, I don't know who invented this, but saying to people who are suffering profoundly, there are no words. And you say, but there are words, right? We're just too scared to say those words. And I think often about how vulnerable people feel when they encounter real pain. Mm. And this loss was so destabilizing that I remember at one point my therapist said to me, because I was talking about Ruby and Hart all the time, and he said, I want to tell my wife about Ruby and Hart, but she can't bear it. It will destroy her to even the thought of that, of these beautiful humans.
It won't destroy her.
Right. No. And I think there's, because even here, there's some stories that even hearing them make the whole ground shake. And we feel, we take on this false sense of safety and security. And, you know, we project far into the future as if we're going to all make it to the future. And then sometimes things happen that remind us that it's all a mirage. It's, you know, that it's not, it's nothing's for certain. And so I think there's this kind of avoidance that comes from the side of the, you know, of the community, of the friends, of the, you know, even family can feel this way. Like if I get too close to the pain, I might catch the pain or something. And as a result, I think we don't know what to do. And then here's this tradition that's like thousands of years old. And it says, no, this is what you do. So you don't know what to do. You show up. You show up every single night for 7 days and you bring bagels. And, you know, and like, if I recall, Gail, your table was just like this mountain of bagels. And but it was like people understood that there was something that they were being asked to do. And I want to talk about Jewish ritual. I want to talk about where Jewish ritual also failed you, because you address this in the book. But one of the things that you did at Shiva, at the advice of Jesse Zilberstein, another bereaved mother, beloved bereaved mother in our community, was that you told people what you needed at Shiva, and then you told them again what you needed after Shiva, and then again and again. And you share this very generously in the book, what Gail wrote when going back to work, how you spoke to colleagues, how you spoke to friends, because people feel so unstable, uncertain, don't know how to get close to the pain. So before we return to the question of Jewish ritual and alternative ritual, can you talk about the experience of learning that you can help people find the words and find the right way to behave with you? Telling people, no, I want to hear about Ruby. I want you to ask me about Ruby and Hart. How you came to that, and how you found the words yourself to share with other people what you needed here.
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but could I just ask, how old were you?
Oh, yeah, thanks for asking. So Hart was 14, and Ruby was 17. Yeah, 17 and 14. I think that impulse that like, what do I say? What do I say to people who've lost this? And And I think it comes from this feeling like, oh, it's on you to help fix their pain or to give them comfort. And what do you say? I have nothing to say. I can't comfort them. And you're right. You can't comfort them. That's not what you're supposed to do. Don't try and comfort them, because comforting words are, in a sense, efforts to take away their pain, right? Any offering of comfort in can be read as stop feeling so much pain, right. Stop grieving. Right. But in fact, people who've lost somebody have to feel the pain, because if they love somebody and that person dies, that's painful. That's the flip side of love. You can't get away from it. You know, you can pretend, you could bottle it up and pretend, but it doesn't work ultimately. So really the words are to have the conversation about the person who's died, you know. So it's not on the person to fix the problem, it's on the person to allow the person who's grieving to talk. And to share your own. Some of the most beautiful things that were said to me were expressions of love for Ruby and Hart. Mm-hmm. Those were the best things I received in my grief. Somebody coming up and saying, I love Ruby so much. She was so funny and crazy. And oh my God, she was so inspiring. And you know, I think about her and her badass lesbian self and her blue hair, Hart and his ridiculous characters and his voices that he said. You know, like just that. And then if they burst into tears, that was great. I used to say, I love watching little kids cry, you know? Uh-huh. Ruby and Hart's friends come up and cry, I love it. Some strange, sadistic side. But no, it wasn't. It was community. It was like, I'm in pain, and I feel so alone, and if somebody else is in sharing my pain, because they're also in pain, great. You know, I had this moment where I realized people would come over to our house, and they'd be all kind of chipper, and then they would sneak away, and then they'd cry in the bathroom. Mm-hmm. And I could hear them crying secretly. Like, what are you doing? And it was like to protect me from crying. I'm like, oh, I cry so much. Oh, you have no idea. And I need to cry. If I didn't cry for a while, I would start to feel ill, like physically ill inside myself. Mm. So my relationship to crying changed radically. I've gone off topic now.
That's what, it's all one big conversation, so it's totally fine. But I remember one evening at Col Nidre, when we had a speaker, it was a couple of years after the crash, and the speaker was also hit by a drunk driver and survived. And I realized in the middle of this woman speaking that I hadn't given you a heads up. And we actually had spoken right before the holiday came in. We talked, and because I was thinking of you, as I always am, and I remember I snuck over to you both, and I said, I'm so sorry, I should have given you a trigger warning, and you said, the whole world triggers us. Like, we don't need to hear about someone getting hit by a drunk driver to be triggered. We're constantly thinking about our kids, we're constantly aware of this, you know, dynamic, and you said, it's actually comforting to hear other people talk about you know, their struggles. And so I think that's so interesting, because people, I've heard from many people, like, I don't know, should I ask about the kids? Should I ask about the grief? What if they're doing well today? And then I'm going to remind them, and you're like, no, we're always aware of it. We're always thinking about it.
Yeah,
it's just less lonely when people ask about it, which is an important thing for people who aren't grieving to know about.
Yeah, yeah. And I think there's some people out there, because I get this, you know, on Instagram, now and again, I'll get like the contrarian who says like, well, don't some people not want to talk about the people they've lost? And isn't that going to cause them pain? And I'm thinking, well, if somebody comes up, say you lost your wife, Harriet, right? And it feels too painful to talk about Harriet. And someone comes up to you and says, oh my God, Harriet meant so much to me, and she was this light of my life, and I miss her so much. Is that really going to cause you pain, or is that going to feel good? It's going to feel good. Sorry, it's going to feel good to hear about Harriet. And frankly, the narrative, the cultural narrative is the opposite, is like, don't talk. Let's assume everybody is traumatized by their losses and doesn't want to ever think about their loved one ever again. Mm-hmm. And that's the main narrative that we get. And so I think it's a radical minority of people who don't want to talk about the person they've loved the most in their life who's now dead.
And if you're speaking to one of those people, they can say that.
Exactly, right? Exactly. They can say, you know, I don't want to talk about Harriet today.
Right.
But I'm pretty sure if you're talking about how much you love Harriet, that it's going to feel good to that person.
Yeah, you speak in the book a little bit about Gail's family and Barbara and how that was part of your coming to this particular approach about in your own grief. And by the way, I mean, when I saw this right from the beginning with both of you, your desire, your need to speak, and I mean, both Gail and Colin spoke at the funeral, which was very surprising, I think, to many people, and spoke so beautifully and powerfully. And both of the eulogies are in the appendix of the book, so you can read them. But it seemed immediately that immediately and instinctively that you understood that you needed to try to put some words to this tragedy, even though you knew that you couldn't ever say everything, obviously, that needed to be said here. Can you talk a little bit about how you came to that?
Yeah, yeah. I like that last part you just said about you can't say everything. I think that also is hard for people. It's like, how can I start to talk about this person who means everything to me? Because how could I ever do them justice? And it's like, so they don't say anything. And it's like, well, no, just literally anything helps. And so, Gail and I were both writers and from the theater world, and it was just no way I was not going to talk about my children at the funeral. That's like, no, I'm going to talk about them because they're everything to me. And I want to share that. But we wrote our eulogies like in the middle of the night, just sort of like, oh my God, the funeral's tomorrow. I think we wrote the night before. Yeah. Gail wrote two. She wrote one at like 1 o'clock, and then at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, she's like, you know what? I got to get more raw. And she wrote another one at like 4 o'clock in the morning. I remember seeing that happen. I love both of them. But I think that just putting our pain into words is so helpful because it's so hard to process it. How can we process what's happening to us if we're not articulating it or expressing it in some way? Hence finding the words. But I think it's true for anything. It's how we process anything in life. We have to articulate it in some way, write it down, say it to somebody, a friend, or transform it into art, something.
There's a debate in the Talmud where the rabbis say, in the traditional prayer, in the standing prayer, the Amidah, it says, Ha'el, Ha'gadol, Ha'gibor, V'hanora. There's a certain number of adjectives that are describing God. And one rabbi felt like it wasn't enough. So he started adding more and more adjectives. It's not only you're great and you're mighty and you're awesome, but also you're wonderful and you're majestic and you're transformative. And so another rabbi came up and said, why are you stopping now? If you're going to say that, why don't you keep going and keep going? Because you can never say everything. So instead we say something. Like just knowing that we can't ever use all the words to describe. And I think this is going back to circling back to the Jewish ritual piece that you were talking about earlier. I think this is part of the power of the Jewish response to the death of a loved one is there's the funeral. And then there's Shiva, and it's night after night after night of just the community creating a container to hold the bereaved family and make the space for them to share. Where are you today? And what memories are you lifting up in this moment? And what are you most afraid of right now? And what are you most like? What are you feeling most deeply in this moment? And so you get in the pattern. It's like doing it once is an incredible act of courage, but doing it seven times, night after night after night, puts you in the pattern, develops the muscle of sharing memory. Mm-hmm. And so the hope is that even when Shiva ends and you re-enter, you don't fully re-enter the world, but you enter the next phase of grieving, which is less intense than the first week. You've already established the muscle for sharing, and so you have that combined with what you were describing about, like the way that we counter death denial with placing earth on the coffin. You talk about the thud in the book, right? The sound of earth. It's not trying to. We're not pretending that things aren't what they are, and it's so brutal, and yet it's what places us on a path toward some ultimately solace, as you say, or consolation, eventual consolation.
Yeah, yeah.
You also talk in the book about, and I'm so moved by your description of Jewish ritual. And as I've told you, some people in our community have said to me, it was the most, that Gail's non-Jewish husband wrote the most beautiful and powerful description of Jewish ritual I've ever heard in my life, and you did.
I'm an atheist, too. Non-Jewish atheist.
you really understand the Jewish rituals very deeply. But also you write about the ways in which the Jewish ritual failed to hold you, too. And or I don't know if we'd say
failed.
I don't
use the word fail.
The limits of our Jewish tradition when it comes to, like, yeah. Post... So after Shiva, do you want to take
yes.
us through
yes.
your
so,
thinking?
So Shiva's the first 7 nights. And then there's Shloshim, which means 30, which is the first 30 nights after the funeral. And you're supposed to mark the end of Shloshim with some kind of a ritual. And so I don't say that it failed me. That's Sharon's feeling. her own tortured relationship to... any rate. no, because actually marking the end of Shloshim, you have to have some sort of rituals, and you have to make it up because there's no guideline for you. And that was amazing to Gail and I because we had to come up with our own ritual, and that empowered us to then move forward after Shloshim, continuing to create rituals. So I thought it was kind of like this, you know, Jewish wisdom to not tell you what to do, just tell you do something, and then you figure out, oh, I can do my own rituals, actually. We realized we have to keep doing it. So Shloshim ended. We had this powerful, beautiful, and very painful ceremony gathering people in the LA Arboretum, which was another favorite place for our whole family, Ruby and Gail and I and Hart. And we gathered our friends, and there was songs and prayers and holding hands and stories and crying. And then we realized we want to keep doing that. We, you know, a few months go by and there's another holiday that comes up, right? So the anniversary of their first birthdays, how do we get through those, right? The first anniversary of their death, what do we do there? I know, we do a ritual. We were going to pull some people towards us, and we're going to share Ruby and Hart and our pain with our community, and that's going to get us through.
And you, each step of the way, invited the community to meet you where you were and to join you in this grief. And you talked about you write about the grief spiel, which I referenced earlier, but feels relevant here because I think the fact is that most people, when encountering friends, family, community who lose loved ones, have really good intentions, like really want to do the right thing, want to bring comfort, consolation, and just don't know how, don't have the tools. Mm-hmm. I want to talk about both sides of it, both you telling people what you needed, and you have a few really incredible stories in here of, like, friends who just, with all the right intentions, are driving you nuts because they're doing something that just feels like it's not what you need, but you know it's coming with love. And so how do you not just retreat and say, I can't be around these people anymore. So I'd love if you can share a little bit with that. But also, you know, some of the things that we do say that can be not just unhelpful, like one of our friends who lost a child who texts me regularly when people write to her saying, I totally know how you feel. My cat just died. And she says, I'm so sorry that your cat died, but you don't know how I feel because I had a son. And so, she finds that to be incredibly unhelpful in her grief and might even be hurtful. And so, obviously, I don't think anyone wants to hurt a bereaved person. And yet we do. So can you tell us a little bit about what you found to be helpful and what you found to be hurtful or even just comedic, and we should avoid it so that we're not the brunt of the joke once we leave the room?
First of all, I, because I had no cultural background in grieving, and I was really bad at helping other people in grief, right? So I was the person that would back away and be like, oh, I guess they don't need, I'm going to leave them alone because they feel sad, so I'm just going to back away. So I think that allowed me to have a lot of empathy for my friends who maybe were backing away from me, mm-hmm. because I would have done the same times 10. And so there was that empathy component, understanding, and because a lot of people in grief, in our grief groups, I would hear a lot of bitterness in the grief groups. You know, oh, you're going to lose all your friends, you're going to lose your family, they're going to fail you in your time of need. You'll find out who your true friends are. I'm like, well, I think all my friends are kind of true. They probably just need a little help. Like I would need help. So that helped me to realize I can articulate what I need to my friends. They want some guidance. So that was the grief spiel. The grief spiel is we'd pull people aside, Gail and I, one at a time, and say, here's the deal. We need to talk about Ruby and Hart and say their names, because people didn't know. They thought, if I say Ruby and Hart, they're going to lose it. And I'm like, no, we need that. And part of my spiel actually was, I don't give a shit about your dead cat. That was in my spiel, because we did have friends who did have a beloved cat die, and they started talking about they weren't comparing, but we just knew that they were upset that their cat died, and they were coming to our house, and we're like, oh shit, I'm gonna lose it if they talk about that cat. I can't do that. So we told them ahead of time, I don't give a shit about your dead cat, or your dead grandma, or your cousin who died 10 years ago, because in acute grief we had no room for empathy for other people's losses. We didn't have space for it. We didn't. Now I do. I have a lot of empathy for people who lose their cat. Because I do. No, I genuinely do. I love my dog, and my dog's going to die, and it's going to be heartbreaking because Ruby and Hart picked that dog. So that was Ruby and Hart's dog. And so when that sweet dog dies, it's going to be heartbreaking. So now I'm in a place where I can appreciate other people's losses. But at the time, I didn't. And so telling people that was very helpful to protect me.
One of the things that you speak about a lot in the show, actually, because Colin has this one-man show that Stacey mentioned earlier that you should all see, which is similar to the book, but different.
Different.
I remember when you started writing this, it was in the very early weeks, right?
Yes.
After the crash, and you were like, it's too dark, we can't show you. And I said, no, I want to see it. And Gail said, you can't share this with Sharon, it's too dark. And it's dark and it's funny and it's really honest, like everything that you do. But you talk about this kind of comparative analysis between people who've experienced loss and the development of your own thinking as a mourner, from that place that you're just describing now of acute trauma and acute grief, where you really can't make space for someone else, and even the feeling in the grief groups, like, oh, you think that's bad? Wait until you hear what this is. To sort of your heart, starting to open again after some time, and being able to, identify with all different kinds of loss, and I wonder if you could speak a bit to that.
Yeah, you gotta go see my show. It's in New York, so you gotta tell your New York friends. It's out here in LA, but it's already sold out. But the run in New York, it's not. So March 29th to April 16th, all your fly to New York, get all your friends to go. Grief@onemanshitshow.com tells you the tickets. But I think kind of early on the show I wrote, I finished writing it within the first 5 months after the crash. So it's a really it's in that place of fresh grief, but I think very quickly I sort of felt myself go through the cycle where I didn't give a shit about everybody. Everybody else was terrible, and then I'm like, oh, a lot of people are in pain. Oh, I'm not so special. Oh, I get it. And I think it's like, understanding pain. I think I have a different understanding of pain now. I appreciate it. I get what pain feels like, and I didn't before. We all have pain. So there's that component. So that's the arc. My character in the play goes on that arc. So I say some very raw things, some not so flattering things, and then I come around by the end. I hope.
It's so honest in a way that we aren't usually about about those feelings. And so I think people will really deeply appreciate it. Like you're cringing when Colin's speaking about it. And then there is an evolution to the thinking.
And there's people, it's very darkly funny. And some people, they're laughing. And I'm thinking, right. You're just laughed at that joke.
That's sick. You've got problems. Do you realize what you just laughed at? I was just talking about other people with dead children, and you're laughing at that. It's nice. It's nice to get dark.
You did set it up so that we'd laugh. We're not just sick. Yeah. I mean, you
no,
said
that's
it
true. I do invite that to happen, yes.
I want to share something that Ruby wrote that I think about literally daily for the last several years. And you write it in the book. You actually put the whole essay there. But within the couple of weeks after the crash, and by the way, I remember when you gave me a little bit of the spiel corrective once because I called it an accident. And you said this wasn't an accident. Remember, Gail? And you said we don't use that, right?
Yeah,
we don't use that language.
Crash. Because the woman who hit us, she didn't accidentally get drunk or high, and she didn't accidentally get behind the wheel, and she didn't accidentally speed. So it wasn't an accident. Yeah.
So
it was a crash.
The crash. And thank you for telling me that, and for us all. So I remember that you were trying to go through the kids' computers and just get like artifacts of their lives, and you came across this essay which you ended up sharing at the Shloshim, this beautiful ritual that we did in the LA Arboretum, reading this essay, and the essay. I'd love if you can sort of take us through it, because I want to tell you that, well, first tell us what Ruby wrote and the metaphor that she uses, and then I want to share with the community here the way that lives in me, if that's okay.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So Ruby wrote this essay. She was a junior in high school, and she wrote this, I guess it's just like an essay assignment called The Ocean, but it was very raw and real, and it was about her struggles with OCD. And it's really exquisitely written. Proud of my girl. And she talks about in the essay, I'm not going to do it justice here, you got to read it, but the feel in her body as she walks down to the water's edge and she sees the big waves coming. And for her, the big waves were her OCD, and being pulled under, being sucked out of control, being taken down. And then instead of running away, she swims out towards it. Mm-hmm. And she dives down under those waves, and maybe she gets rolled, maybe she doesn't, but she trusts that the wave's going to pass over. Mm-hmm. And then she'll get out past the wave, and maybe more waves will come, but for a while there, she's okay. Mm-hmm. Because OCD, pain, whatever it is, heartbreak comes in waves. And it's not unendurable. You don't get sucked in and stay there forever. You get brought back. And so she was trusting in that. And I know that the day that she was talked about was actually my birthday. I have this tradition of having a big party at the beach. And in one particular year, there were really big waves. And I remember I taught Ruby how to swim in the ocean. She was fearless, and we would swim out past the big waves and out past the breakers, and it was quite beautiful. So it was touching to me to know that that was the day that she was talking about, and she's using that to talk about her struggle with her OCD. And now for me, it's how I think about grief, grief coming in waves, and I can make it through this one and think about Ruby.
I mean, just the level of wisdom and insight that your child had is just breathtaking, and I think it is the most profound guidance that I've ever heard for helping us survive grief. And I've shared it with so many people who've grieved since then. And I remember when you found it and we were just, you read it to me over the phone and we were kind of in awe of it. And you said, is it appropriate or inappropriate for me to bring it to the Arboretum or something? And I said, you have to bring this. And you said, do you see what she's saying? You have to swim toward it. You have to swim toward it. And I think the idea of Ruby at 16 at the time, I think when she wrote it, sort of planting this message for the two of you to find about how you could survive this by swimming toward it and swimming toward it. And that is really the very essence of of what you've both done so powerfully in this in the work that you've both created since the crash. And I'm so moved that she gave that to you and that she gave it to us. And it continues to reverberate, and I think to help has helped many, many people. And her, I see this as her core Torah. This is like the one of the core teachings of her life that will continue to reverberate for, I think, for generations to come. I know that people want to have questions that you want to ask Colin, and so we want to give you a chance to engage in a couple of minutes of conversation, and then I have a particular way that I want to bring us to close today.
Oh, so, okay.
Do folks have questions or thoughts you want to share?
There's microphone's coming around.
Well, I was the one that asked the age. I really would like to know a little bit more about each one of your, if you maybe could briefly just talk about each Ruby and Hart.
Yes. Yes. So Ruby was this extraordinarily gifted artist. Oh, I have artwork on her, on my body of hers. So she did these amazing koi wolves. And I love them. I love them because they're kind of like an expression of her kookiness. which is, she did a wolf, but like as a koi fish. So I could see in her because I opened up her art files and I saw the koi fish references she had. So she had these koi fish, and then she was drawing these wolves, and then she gave them these long koi fish whiskers and color patterns of, I don't know. And she was like this amazing rock star in her school. And this was true while she was alive. So it's not just because she was killed. While she was alive, teachers came up to me and said, "You don't understand. Ruby's changed the culture of the school. She's like this powerhouse of anti-bullying. All the little kids go to her, and she protects them from everybody. It's changed the culture of the school." Before she was killed. So it's not like they were, you know, eulogizing somebody. It was true because she was super cool and badass. She was like this powerful butch lesbian warrior for social justice. That was Ruby. And also she was like a crazy goofball. So we discovered this list of things in her computer that said like awesome things to know. And there was a wonderful combination of like, you know, different kind of martial arts and, you know, flying helicopters, and then like knitting and crochet and cleaning things. And so she was into cosplay, and she would build her own costumes. So she could sew. She got a sewing machine, and she was an amazing seamstress. And she would do all these amazing, nerdy cosplay outfits. And Hart was like this class clown, total goofball. He was just a nonstop generator of ridiculous characters. Many of them are wildly offensive. Or wildly inappropriate, I guess is the right word. It was just literally nonstop. Like at the dinner table, I would be, you know, frustrated. Like, knock it off, Art. Just eat your dinner. Because he just has a constant font of entertainment. And his friends all were like that. It's strange, but he was like the coolest kid in the crowd, and he was the life of any party he was in. That's the truth. Thanks for asking.
How did they get along with each other?
They loved each other. It was quite extraordinary. They were each other's champion. Yeah, he was like in awe of her art. It was beautiful. And he was a champion for her. And she thought he was the funniest thing. they had this routine when they were younger. She would dress him up and then come out and say, "Now introducing so-and-so," and then he would come out in character and do a whole skit, but she was like the director and he was like the artist. And they loved each other so. I talk about it in the book, their aunt and niece came one whatever summer, and we were going out for dinner, and the aunt and the niece wanted to show this game, this cool game. What it is you say a word, and then the two people say the first thing that pops in their head, and if they say the same word, they win a point. And this aunt and niece, we love them, Betsy and Rafi, they were so psyched. You could tell that they were good at this game, that they had practiced it a lot, and they were pretty good at it. And they were going to cream Ruby and Hart. And Ruby and Hart were like, "Okay, we'll play this game." And they said the same word every time.
It was like insane. It was like jaw dropping. And it was like, we asked them afterwards, are you like that in sync? And Ruby said, oh, no, no, no. I just said the first word that would have popped into Hart's mind. Because she just knew what Hart would think. So, yeah, they were very, they squabbled. They weren't like, you know, they squabbled, but they were an incredible team. Yeah.
I think you said that that each of them pretended to like the thing that the other one loved the most, yeah, just so that they could do it together.
Yeah, I talked about it in the book and in my show that he pretended to love anime and cosplay and manga. He really did, and she believed him, and she had no clue. And at one point, I believed him. He's a good actor, and at one point, he pulled me aside and said, "Dad, I don't like any of that. I'm just pretending." It's like, oh. And then I saw Ruby pretended to love hip-hop. He loved hip-hop, and she pretended. And so they'd sit and listen to hip-hop in the backseat of my car all the time. But she hated hip-hop. She had zero hip-hop on any of her playlists, but she just pretended to have fun with him. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you. If you had not had a community like you have, and you had not had traditions to walk you through the early grieving period, and if you had not had friends who actually listened to you, what direction do you think you would have gone in, especially in the book?
Yeah, I don't know. It's hard to imagine that dark flip side of reality. I did have a beautiful community, and Ikar came out for me in an amazingly powerful way. So, which speaks to your point, without that, you know, I would hope that I would have searched for a community. I mean, I did join grief groups. Gail and I both joined multiple grief groups. So we seeked out community in addition to the community we already had. I don't know if, I mean, we're theater kids, so maybe we would have thought about having rituals on our own. I don't know. Yeah. I read a lot of grief books, which were very helpful. Not as helpful as mine. but they were very helpful. They were very helpful to me. I also got frustrated with them in different parts, but they were helpful.
Can I add something to this? Because I'm so... I saw the community and the presence of the community, and it's incredible and wonderful, and I'm so grateful to our community for stepping up as they did. And it was hard because there was reverberative trauma happening throughout the community. And I really understand and appreciate the power of Jewish ritual, obviously, as a rabbi. And there's something about the two of you also that is really at the heart of this story, which is the incredible instinctive tenderness that you showed to each other through this process, walking through unimaginable sorrow and heartache, and holding softness with one another. And from the moment that we got to the house the first day, through weeks and months and now years, and I'm so struck by that. It's so precious and rare, and it's really quite incredible. And the other thing is, I remember, and I can't remember which of your eulogies it was in, but one of you wrote about, now when you go to Paris, you'll be able to eat the good food instead of the food Hart always made you eat in Paris, which was like the fast food pizza or something. And I remember some of you were there at the funeral, and I just thought, did Gail just say they're going to go to Paris? Like, their kids just died, and I don't even know how they're going to wake up tomorrow. But Gail and you already were envisioning, we're going to live, we're going to have a future. There is something beyond this, and you swam toward the grief, and you were deep in it. And I think in many ways you're still deep in it, and also,
in many ways.
In many ways, and also you've traveled again, and you know, you got on a plane and went to Italy, mm-hmm. and you eat good food and you have love and friendship and community around you. And so that is also, to answer Florine's question, I think, I mean, there's community and there's ritual, and those things are lifesavers. And also built into your marriage and built into your own hearts was, I think, an orientation toward life. Mm. And that's something that I just want to recognize and affirm in both of you.
Thank you. Yeah.
I had a question. I was wondering how you managed to, within yourself or within the world, come to some terms with the person who drove the car.
Oh, yeah. It's very interesting. I don't think I've come to terms yet. I think I've we're privileged in that we don't have to deal with her yet. There hasn't been a trial. She's in prison, but there has not been a trial yet. And because we know a lot of people whose children have been killed by drunk drivers, and the reality is that most of them get very, very light sentences, and then those people who are grieving have to deal with that. That reality that now they're out free living their lives, and here we are, you know, shattered. And so in a way I don't have to deal with that, wrestle with that right now. I can put that off, that traumatic thing off. But what's also interesting, I went to prison, just 2 weeks ago, through someone in ECAR, about restorative justice. And so I spoke with a group of 50 men who were in for murder, and there were some who were there for drunk driving. And we talked a little bit about forgiveness, and what that's like. And they asked me, do you forgive the woman who hit you? And I was like, well, I give this version of this answer, but I don't have to deal with it yet. I haven't thought about that, but I think it feels to me like I don't know anything about where she's at emotionally. I don't know how she feels about us. The night of the crash, she didn't feel too good about us. She said some, you know, terrible things and behaved in a way that there was no remorse. So maybe she's remorseful now. But talking to these men in prison who were remorseful is very interesting. Some of these men were serving life sentences for people they'd killed when they were 18 years old, and they're now 45, and they're looking at another 25 more years of life or life in prison. Some of them, and there was remorse, and so I think that's interesting. I don't know.
We have time for one more question.
Oh,
would you write? Would you write the shit show today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I wouldn't. It would be different. It would be a different show now, because it came out of a real necessity. I needed to write it, and I needed to express these dark feelings that I had, the anger that I was struggling with, and so I don't have that impulse. Afterwards, I had the impulse to write this book. This came after, which is much, I don't know, friendlier and hopefully more useful than my show, but less funny. My show's funnier. But I do love my show, and I feel like it's very truthful and honest for where that's at. Yeah.
Where you were at that time.
Yeah, exactly. So everything's still truthful. So when I say all those words, I still connect very much to them, but it's not what I would write, if that makes sense. It all feels real and true to me as I say it on stage, but it's not what I'm most thinking about, I guess. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I want to close by asking you if there's a Ruby story and a heart story that you want to share with us. Uh-huh. And while you're thinking, I'm just going to tell you the heart story that I think about all the time is the story of Hart walking with his weird, cool, eclectic group of friends on campus and seeing a girl who's not okay, sitting and crying and asking her if he can join her. And I think he asks her, you know, do you want me do you want to talk about what's going on, or do you want me to distract you and make you laugh? And she said, please make me laugh. And he did. And they weren't friends. Like, he's, I mean, that's just, this is a 14-year-old child who saw another child in pain and wasn't freaked out by it, and didn't make fun of her with his friends, and didn't just walk on, but actually saw her and engaged her, and she will hold that story forever, and I hold that story forever, and it's in here too. It's in the book. And Ruby, if I may, there's a story. I think I shared this in my eulogy that we learned where it's Ruby, because she loved the ocean so much, that she had gone with her class to the beach, oh, yeah. And a couple boys went out too far, because boys do that kind of thing, and they got stuck in the current, and they like couldn't come back. And Ruby, she like went out there, and she's like, "You listen to me. You hold on to me, and I will bring you back to shore. I will bring you back to shore." And they were so scared, and they did, and she brought them back. And I just think of this like incredibly triumphant kid who had been through so much and really found herself. And was literally saving other kids' lives, and I'm so in love with these humans, and will always continue to, I think, take inspiration from what they intrinsically knew, even as teenagers, even as children.
Yeah, she was a powerful swimmer. It was pretty beautiful. I love that she rescued these kids out of a current. But a rip current. But I'll tell a ridiculous story. That seems appropriate, right? So we were in Costa Rica, and we were on a family vacation, and Hart was asking us questions about. There was a bunch of girls who were asking him out, and he was like, I don't want to say yes to these girls, but I don't want to hurt their feelings, but I also don't want to like encourage them. I need to say no, but how do I do it? And Gail and I were like trying to give him advice, and we were doing the best we could. But I was like, you know, honestly, I'd never had that problem, Hart. I can't help you, really. I don't know what that's like. Sorry. But Ruby had amazing advice. I don't even know what it was. But I remember she said it after we talked. Gail and I talked. And then Ruby said, here's what you should write, Hart, because it's all about texting. What do I text these girls back? And she had the perfect thing. We're like, oh, God, yeah, do what Ruby said. And so we're having this conversation. And then all of a sudden, we sit down on these rocks, and this bat flies out of nowhere and slams into the ground right between us, a bat. And I'm like, oh, my God, there's a bat there. And it froze. It didn't move. And so this is sort of classic. Ruby's like, I've got to save the bat. It's stuck. The bat must be stuck. I'm going to get a stick, and I'm going to get in there. I'm going to rescue the bat. And Hart's like, no. The bat, it must have broken its wing. The poor bat's suffering. We've got to put it out of its misery. This poor bat is dying, and it's terrible. I'll get a rock. So he goes off to get a rock. Ruby goes off to get a stick. And Gail's like, no. The rat might have rabies. This is insane. Stay away from the bat. And I'm like, I think the bat's fine, guys. They're like, no. So Ruby gets a stick, and Hart gets a rock. And they're arguing, and getting bigger and bigger. It's a big, big fight. And the bat just takes off and flies away. The bat was fine. The bat was just chilling for a minute. I have no idea what was going on, but yeah, that was a sort of classic Ruby and Hart moment where they were fighting each other. They were fought each other too. Like, Hart, put the rock away. Ruby, put the stick away. It was really important. Yeah.
I want to say to close. We spent a lot of time together after this happened, and as I said, you were already future orienting from the beginning. But I wish I could have also handed you and you both a glimpse of of now, you know, a few years later, and Gail made a movie and TV and wrote a book, and you wrote a book, and you have a show, and your art is not the only expression of your vitality. But it is an expression of your fierce desire to live. And I know that, like two little ants at the bottom of every page in Gail's book, that their spirits are so present in you. And now, because you've allowed our community and now the broader community of anybody who has the good grace to pick up this book, you've invited all of them into our hearts. And so we will continue to hold their memories for the rest of our lives now, and we can share in the brilliance and the wisdom and the beauty of Ruby and Heart. So thank you both for sharing them with us and with the world. And if you haven't yet, this book is an incredible gift. So treat yourself and 10 friends to the book. And thank you, Colin, for writing it.
Thank you, Sharon. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible by the Hearst Foundation, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the Los Angeles County Department of Arts and Culture, Errant Fox, City National Bank, the Los Angeles Public Library, and additional generous supporters of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. To support programs like this, become a member at lfla.org.